Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this afternoon from a hazy, cool day here in south-central British Columbia. In today's episode, we're going to provide listeners with a treasure trove of health advice to empower you and your families for this upcoming fall and winter season. Don't become a statistic. Take what you learned today to prevent common illnesses like colds and flus and work towards improving your overall health for long-term benefits and gains. Remember, knowledge is power. Arm yourself with it. Backed by popular demand, and joining us again today for this episode is Dr. Mark Sherwood. Dr. Sherwood was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and raised in nearby Berry Hill. He is a former Oklahoma State and Regional Bodybuilding Champion and ex-professional baseball player. Dr. Sherwood is also a certified naturopathic doctor, and together with his wife, Michelle Neal Sherwood, a doctor of osteopathy, they founded the Functional Medical Institute, a full-time wellness-based medical practice in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dr. Sherwood is also a 24-year retired veteran of the Tulsa Police Department, where he logged a decade of courageous service on the department's SWAT team. During his tenure there, he exemplified the concept of being the first one to go through the door and face whatever challenge was on the other side. At the Functional Medical Institute, Dr. Sherwood and his wife have adopted a whole person approach, which is an outcome-based look at each individual's unique needs. Their goal is to lead people down the pathway of true healing by first eradicating all self-imposed, choice-driven disease conditions, and second, to eliminate the usage of unnecessary medications. Dr. Sherwood, welcome back to the show. It's an honor to speak with you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, Michael, I've been looking forward to coming back on. I'm super honored to be with you and excited about our discussion today.
Outstanding. So much has happened since we last spoke. The world has become slightly more mad. Any pressing issues or concerns that have caught your attention or anything that you'd like to get off your chest?
Yeah, actually, I see more in America, that is. I see more, and probably in Canada too, I see more what I consider bondage. Now, let me explain what I'm talking about. There's bondage to this idea, almost like three prisons. And I think these are prisons are so subtle and so clear, Michael, that people are not getting it. Number one's the bondage to the prison of big government. Big government is the thing that sort of makes people dependent upon them for a check, for sustenance, for food, for protection, for cell phones, for insurance, the whole bit. You become completely solely reliant upon big government. And therefore, you become in bondage. The second big bondage thing is called big pharma, big drug, big food. And those are people that get stuck in the idea of, I've got to have my medications and I'm waiting for the politicians to make the medication prices even lower so that I can make sure I can afford them. And they're out for my benefit because they want me to have more drugs. While I consume their food, that actually makes me more sick, dependent upon more drugs. That's the second bondage. The third bondage is kind of like subtle, but it's really been bothering me because within big church, like big institutionalized church, you know, there's people that, you know, we live in North America, a place we still can actually grab a Bible, own it, and read it. You know, it's a blessing in itself. But we're becoming so dependent upon a big celebrity pastor or spiritual leader to teach us a couple of little things in a 15-minute little motivational speech on a Sunday morning or a Saturday morning and not learning how to do it our own. So we become totally reliant upon that person to teach us something that's available to us every day, all day, anytime we want. And the reason I think those things collide, those three prisons, it's taken our ability away because we've given it away of the idea of self-government or self-governance and the idea that we can't take care of ourselves because we're so stupid, because we don't know how to think and we don't know how to critically think about anything. So we become so helpless and therefore in bondage to the big three prisons.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation. And certainly this is an outsourcing of one's own responsibility, whether it's, you know, for the, you're earning your daily bread or your food and your medicine, you know, which should be one and the same. And then of course, you know, looking for somebody else for a spiritual connection to the Creator. And that's, you know, none of those are going to serve you well. And an interesting interview that was conducted with David Icke a couple weeks back, he was talking about this lack of self-respect that a lot of these COVID measures have put onto people. And so once you've dumbed yourself down to the point where you put on a face diaper upon entering a building and you abdicate any level of reason, your self-respect disappears. And the more that your self-respect is whittled away, the more subject you are to these three prisons of entrapment.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the idea of what's COVID done to us, it's made us not reliant upon what we are as human beings with a wonderful adaptive immunity that can adjust and overcome what we deal with. Remember, we've existed for centuries, millennia, eons, like we are right now, without the help of a face diaper, without the help of a vaccine. And again, people can do what they want, your choice, my choice, whatever. That is freedom. But we need to be able to think critically through it and be what I consider truly informed, like an informed consent. And that's something that has been taken away, probably, Michael, because we've allowed it. We didn't have the confidence, the self-confidence, the self-appreciation to stand up and say, you know what? No, I'm not going to do this. And because of that, when you gave authoritarian, oligarchical leaders, they're not leaders, but they're dictators, that authority, all it did was feed their ego, feed their confidence, feed their power.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on that point, it's interesting, when I came back across the border and we elected to drive across versus fly, it was much cheaper and ultimately less hassle. And of course, the Canadian airlines are still encouraging or mandating that passengers wear their diapers. And so pull up to the border crossing, which essentially is outdoor kiosks. And there was this kind of chubby Karen with a face diaper on, you know, that I couldn't understand what she was saying. And, you know, she elected me for a secondary examination. And she said, you know, make sure you wear your mask when you're inside. I said, why would I do that? Well, you know, there's an emergency going on right now. I said, you're out of your mind. I said, I do not wear a mask. Well, you have to, sir. So I just drove away, walked in, no mask on. And kind of a 35-year-old gentleman didn't say anything. Basically looked in the trunk and said, you know, some wine here, pair of shoes here, da-da-da, done. Have a nice day, sir. I think he actually respected the fact that I walked in there with that confidence, that self-determination, caring about my business, because, you know, he's probably got a family to feed, mortgage to pay, and so he's forced to do this ridiculous thing. So here's this, you know, champion of freedom coming in, expressing his individuality and so forth. And I'm pretty sure that's why it went that way, because, you know, it could have gone horribly the other way. You know, here's this non-complier who's, you know, rabble-rouser creating some difficulty. We're going to, you know, tear his vehicle apart down to the, you know, down to the frame. So
we've got to stand up, Michael. I mean, I'm talking, look, whether we're Canadians, it doesn't matter. We're people, man. And the idea, I believe this with all of my heart, humanity, just the idea of humanity, the human experience, is being taken away from us, not because it's being taken away, but because we are allowing it to be shaved away piece by piece and slice by slice. And I find that extremely tragic, because if we think for a moment that these dictators are going to give it back to us because they're just being nice, yeah. I mean, we need to get, as the ostrich goes, we need to get our heads out of the sand and our you-know-whats out of the air.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people have their head up there, you know where, as opposed to in the sand at this point. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I agree with you.
So what do you make of Biden's announcement that I guess was either today or yesterday that he's going to cut cancer deaths in half via the signing of an executive order giving more federal funds, in other words, your money, to the U.S. biotechnology industry?
Yeah, he's completely off. Like, look, let's think about this, and I'm going to talk a little science-y right here, because...
Please.
What is cancer? All right. So cancer is a cell or a grouping of cell that's gone wrong. Okay. So a cell, remember, has three parts. It has a membrane, it has a nucleus, and then it has the space between the nucleus and the membrane, which is the outside wall. It's called the cytoplasm. And the cytoplasm has multiple organelles, inclusive of the organelle called the mitochondria. Now, the cell is the smallest living organism that can live by itself. And when you think about the idea of making a human, you think about cells making proteins, which create tissues, which create organs, which create organ systems, which create organisms. And that's kind of how that works. So everything is from the base cell. And so when you have this idea of a cell that goes from operating efficiently to damaged, wounded, hurt, and operating inefficiently, that would be considered cancer. Now, there's two ways to look at this. One, you could look at it like conventional medicine and says, well, I want to stop the process of cancer because that's bad. But the other way to look at it is, okay, a cell became dysfunctional, and its very idea, Michael, of being dysfunctional communicate to the rest of the cells around the body, inclusive of the immune system made up of cells, right? And the immune system gets the signal that, oh, I've got a cell over here that's rogue. And there's a process in the body called apoptosis, which sees a cell based upon the cell signal and then goes in there and tries to correct it or helps it destroy itself. So is cancer really a way that the body's telling the rest of the system that I need repair and I need some attending to? Or is it just a bad system? Well, I look at it in the previous way. It's a good system. And so when they start looking at biologics and all this stuff, all they're doing is trying to turn off processes or slow down processes of development. And I just think that's wrong. Now, I can see that probably if the system is in a state of heavy metastasis or the cancer spreading everywhere and you got to do something for a window of time to stop the train from going off the tracks, you do that. But you don't stop the train from being a train. And that's the analogy I'm trying to get to people, because something is amiss. I look back at, I don't remember who it was, one of our presidents declared war on cancer. Well, guess what? Ever since that time, cancer deaths have continued to increase. And now they're just barely behind heart disease as the number one killing of all Americans. 600,000 people a year? Are you kidding me? And it's a trend that's shockingly growing so predictably. And when you have a monetization of chemotherapy to the initiators of the chemotherapy, i.e. the doctors or prescribers, we have a problem. So there's multiple layers of this problem. And I think that if he wanted to bring an end or a lowering of cancers, he would probably talk about toxicity in our environment, toxicity in food, stopping government subsidies in food, eating more natural foods. Instead of printing money and giving it all to the damn world, why don't they start making some good food and subsidizing good, healthy, organic farmers in America to get the toxins out? But no, we're not going to do that because that doesn't make money. Let's face it, cancer and sick people are big business.
Yeah, and that's an unfortunate reality. And, you know, you kind of touched on some of the points here in my next question, but, you know, this to me doesn't sound like a means in which to alter the cancer rates. This is just more money into the Democrat funding agencies. As you suggest, you know, we should be looking at the childhood vaccine schedule, food additives, preservatives, pesticides, and the very food that people are consuming, and like a complete redress of what people are putting in their mouths. And, you know, activity levels, mental health, the rest of it, that's what's going to get us through this. And you know, we're not going to see these deaths anymore.
Well, I agree. And when you look at cancers, and we look at a lot of genetic analyses of our folks here, and this is a fascinating statistic that I'm going to share with people. Our genes have only changed 2% in 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. That's it. Just 2%. And all of us are 99%. Plus identical as humans. Well, if you look back historically, even 100 years ago, you did not see cancer at this rate. So if what I said is true in the first statement, that they've only changed 2% in our genetics, and we only seen cancer really escalate over the last 75 to 50 years across the specifically North America, then what's the cause? Well, it's not the genes, so let's stop looking for genetic causes, because that's not true. So could it be the environment? Well, yes, because what you have is you have genes which haven't changed, and you have this environment that's changed multiple times over, leading to what I consider diseases of the incongruent, or incongruency diseases, which mean things like type 2 diabetes, which shouldn't exist, osteoporosis, multiple autoimmune conditions, Alzheimer's, dementia, heart disease, and cancers. And it's fascinating how we're missing that mark, because history, if we look back on it, it has some beautiful treasure troves of information, truth that we can learn from. But instead of learning from history, we want to dismiss history as it's not. And so it goes back to this kind of cancel culture kind of mentality. We've done that with medicine. We've done that with historically what I consider, what my wife and I do, traditional physicians or clinician work, which is bringing healing to the body as opposed to creating more sickness.
Yeah, or looking at the fundamental causes versus treating the symptoms, which just simply generates profit.
Yes, exactly. And we need to look at diseases like this. And this is a good analogy for folks. So we all go to the doctor, and there's two problems with this, what I'm getting ready to say. Number one, we go to the doctor to find out what is wrong. Okay, if you and I are having a question, or you and your lady are having a question in an answer session, if you go to her and you say, hey, I just want you to tell me what's wrong with me. Well, okay, if you keep doing that long enough, I bet you find something. Yeah. Wrong question, bad conversation. And the second part of that is, if you're looking for something wrong and find something wrong, all your attention focuses on what's wrong instead of all the massive things that are right. I look at disease, and my wife does like this. There's groups of symptoms that we all don't like, whatever that would be. And symptoms, we should all know, are grouped together into clumps or clusters. And those clumps or clusters are then labeled as disease conditions, right? Disease conditions downstream from these clusters of symptoms. Okay, what if we instead looked upstream and said, hey, what is causing these symptoms? And if we remediate or resolve the upstream cause of the symptoms, and the symptoms are gone, disease becomes irrelevant. And so we need to begin to look for the causes of the symptoms, as opposed to continue to look for what's wrong. Because that very fundamental process right there, Michael, has set us back literally thousands of years, because we've forgotten the magnificence in the way we are made. I mean, it is extraordinary. How are we even having this conversation today, comprehending it, being able to internalize it, put it into pictures, and communicate it to the masses? Man, that's fascinating to me. And that blows my mind. So the awesomeness of the human body and the way it's wired makes it in itself a healing machine, or we wouldn't be sitting here talking today.
Yeah, absolutely. And humans wouldn't still be wandering the planet this many years later if somehow we were, you know, this collection of a cluster of symptoms. I mean, that's and I think, you know, of course, if we're looking to manage or mitigate the symptoms, we're in this management phase or practice, instead of, like you say, looking for the root cause to eliminate, not just to mask or to cope with the symptoms.
That's exactly right. And that's the problem with big pharma today, especially in really all of North America. I mean, we have become experts at depending upon drugs to manage us. And yeah. I don't know, just a simple thing. And this is a question for the listeners. Would you rather have your diseases managed or healed? That's just a question. You know, I think the answer is pretty obvious. Well, I don't want to deal with that anymore. Just fix it, heal it, whatever word you want to fix or put to that. But the bottom line is, medications are not meant to do that. They're not. And further, when you get into the process of disease or diagnostic work, the way it works, you know, and most people know this in mainstream medicine, if we are looking for what is wrong and spending our time looking for a diagnosis, we're going to list that in a medical chart. Okay. And therefore, you and I get a new name. Instead of my name is Mark and your name is Michael, now I am type 2 diabetes, or I am hypertensive, or I am autoimmune, or I have, you get the idea. So what happens is, even if I do make lifestyle changes and mitigate all those symptoms, and I have no evidence of that disease anymore. Guess what is still in my chart? Guess what is still my name? It will never be removed. And that's tragic, because that is not fundamentally correct. It gives nobody the ability or to permit permission to succeed, overcome, and actually be healed.
That's interesting. And of course, that creates a mental condition as well, which you're never going to apply that faculty in terms of your healing process, because you've identified with the symptoms.
Exactly. And I have a lot of people come into my office where I actually am right now. And I don't let them do this. So I'm very subtle, but I'm nice about it. But, you know, being the co-CEO with my wife, people know I'm real direct. And, you know, one of my favorite books, the Bible, says this: faithful are the wounds of friends, but deceptive are the kisses of enemies. In other words, I don't want to tell you what you want to hear just to please you. I'd rather tell you what you need to hear, even though it may hurt a little bit, because I dearly, truly, respectfully love you very much. So I don't let people here come in here and say, I'm a diabetic. I don't let them do that.
Right.
Or I have autoimmune. Or they get into this and then it translates from I am to it's because of that that I can't. So see, it's a terrible transition, and I can't because of that that was given to me by someone else becomes nothing more than an excuse not to experience life to the fullest.
That's very, very interesting reference shift in terms of opening people's minds and shifting that perception. So let's jump into the bulk of our discussion today. Let's begin by examining the belief that the body, mind, and spirit are equally important in achieving wellness, and that the balanced body has the inherent ability to heal itself.
There's no question the spirit, mind, and body are connected. Give an example, and people can get this. You know, the strongest structure that we know of on planet Earth is that three column structure. Let's think of the body being one, the mind being another, and the spirit being another. And whatever people believe about the spirit is not relevant, but I think everybody in that context will understand that there's the essence of who you are, this voice inside you that says, you know, I probably shouldn't be here right now, or, you know, I'm probably in a good spot. You know, I feel good about this, or, you know, I don't feel good about this. And of course, there's our emotions that can go up and down with the cascades of time. They're very normal. And then there's our physical self. They are so related. How many times do people have a loss of self-worth if something bad happens to them in life and they regressed on the pathway of what we call comfort food eating, or eating terribly? And then they start gaining weight. And then they look in the mirror and they begin to feel that they are not worthy, or feel that they're gross, or they don't like what they see. And that really begins to twist up the essence of who we are. So that mind, body, spirit is intricately connected. And we need to get to the point where when we go into a clinician's office or this encounter, it is wise to seek out clinicians that are going to look at and connect those areas. Because we can't be like this. You can't fragment those things in life. Therefore, you can't fragment them in society. Like, for example, you can't exercise away a bad diet. It won't work. Nor can you pray away a bad diet. I have watched multiple people that would understand what I'm getting ready to say, that this would be witnessing of a truth in their life. The majority of the physical manifestation of diseases are truly rooted in emotional and spiritual brokenness. And let that one sink in just a little bit, ladies and gentlemen. I think that will be one that will get you twisted up a little bit, but also go, you know what? Physical, emotional, spiritual, they are all connected.
Yeah, that I've heard that is now the cutting edge research on MS is showing that may be related to an emotional trauma. Or any trauma, in fact, from people's past or childhood. So that's very, very interesting that you bring that up. And of course, I mean, if you're the other example of, you know, somebody overeating or comfort eating, looking at themselves in the mirror and then constantly reiterating or reinforcing that, you know, I'm awful, I'm terrible, I look like crap. And, you know, that's just filling your body with these negative chemical messengers. And, you know, how can you escape from that? I mean, that's very difficult.
It is. And you mentioned the idea of those adverse childhood events or the ACEs, or adult traumatic events, the ACEs or the AITs, I call them, you know. The bottom line is that creates this cascade of stress within the body. Stress, we should understand, has several biochemical or physiological responses, meaning high blood pressure, muscle tension, vasodilation. Your digestion goes down, your libido goes down. Well, okay, let's go that from the bottom up. If your libido goes down, how's that going to work with your relationship? Not very good, I don't think. That's going to make a friction there. If your digestion goes down, how's that going to work with your physical digestion of food, your ability to draw out nutrients from those food? And we talk about this idea of multiple sclerosis. We're talking about a failure of processes to be able to identify that myelin sheath coming off of those nerve endings, and it's not able to repair them. So anytime you have the dysfunction that's created by this chronic stress, you're going to see that connection. And in every single process of disease, Michael, you're going to see the idea of chronic systemic inflammation, and you're going to see chronic systemic stress. Hand in hand, salt and pepper for everyone.
Interesting. So in your opinion, then, stress is clearly one of the greatest disease vectors.
Yes. I look at stress like it does destroy your entire well-being if not managed. And I'm going to give people like a little tip right here with stress. Stress has been notoriously defined within textbooks, studies, verbiages, books as a noun. Noun's a person, place, or thing, or an idea. So let's think about this for a moment. I could ask the question of you or anybody listening right now, what is stress? And if I ask 100 people, I may get 98 different answers because nobody really knows. So I would propose the idea of this. Turn stress from a noun to a verb. And instead, use this as a definition of stress and see if this doesn't fit better. So stress, therefore, by definition, would be an action we take in response to life's expected or unexpected occurrences. So if that is true, then it becomes a verb and not a noun, giving us control over the action. One simple example would be this. If you get in a traffic jam or a backup and you're late for an appointment, you can get angry, but you're not going to make those cars move any faster. So the cars then are that jam or that pile of backup is the stimulus that you have to make a decision on what you're going to do. You can decide to hit the steering wheel and honk the horn and get angry and have those physiological responses occur that you know I just talked about. Or you can say, okay, maybe this is a divine delay and maybe I need to be quiet for a moment. And I'm going to choose to understand I can't do anything about that, but I can do something about this, and maybe I just need to be quiet, or maybe I need to turn on the radio for some soothing music, or maybe just roll down the window and get some air, right? Imagine those things. It really is a response. It's an action. It's a decision we make. So therefore, it is, in my opinion, a verb instead of a noun.
Yeah, that's an interesting assessment. I agree with you that utilizing it in that way gives it a new meaning and a new means to interpret it. So how can we address stress that underlies Dr. Sherwood, and how can we counteract its effects when we cannot avoid it? And here I'm thinking about folks that are frontline responders or medical professionals where their very existence revolves around stressful situations.
Well, I can give some real tips and real angles of this. And here's why, because my whole life has been spent on the edge, you know, in my life as law enforcement, man, I mean, Michael, you live on the edge. You know, you never know if you're going to die that day. SWAT team, a little more on the edge. You never know what's going to happen. You're just hoping if you get shot, it doesn't hurt too bad. When you're in the clinician work we're in, you can't make a mistake. You got to stay up on the learning. People's lives, their trust, are in your hands. They're right there. And so it's a lot to process. If you're working in an emergency situation and you're some of these first responders, right? You are always on the edge. You live in this chronic stressful environment. And it can indeed and does shorten life. No question. As a matter of fact, the average life expectancy, just statistical wise, of the 20-year retired male police officer in the U.S. is 66 years of age. Not very old. Having said that, here's some key things that people can do. Understand that every day you have to exercise. That's not an option. That is critical. That is mandatory. Movement or exercise metabolizes adrenaline, which people that know a little bit of chemistry, adrenaline is the precursor, very short-lived, to the long-acting hormone called cortisol, which is your stress hormone. So you have to exercise. You don't have to exercise at a high pace. You just have to move. Move. I recommend at least 150 minutes a week of some moderate cardiovascular activity, and I said at least. And then I recommend at least 3 days a week of some sort of resistance or weight training. You have to get some sleep. That would be number two. No matter what you do, you have to have good sleep hygiene practices, which would be things such as maybe an Epsom salt bath, maybe turn the temperature down the house to cold, turn off all stimulating noises such as, fearful TV shows, or if you're reading fearful books or looking at something anxiety laden on the computer, get yourself a pair of blue blocker glasses, because the blue coming out of the computer, the phone, or the TV operates at the temperature of 5,500 Kelvin. Now, for those that want a point of reference, the noonday sun is 3,500. So if you can block that blue light a little bit and get the cortisol to come down, melatonin will come up. You can take magnesium. You can take melatonin. That's never a bad thing. And then the final thing would be, well, you got to eat right. We all know that, right? But the other thing to think about is try to hang out with people, for the most part, that are going to lift you up and not tear you down and not get you all in a tizzy every day. If your discussions are centered upon anger, frustration, or things that just flat out piss you off a lot, it's going to consume you. And this is going to be an addiction. People today are addicted to the dopamine of chaos. And so you can actually become addicted to that cortisol hit. And then, so you want to execute those little tips I just mentioned in there. And also you can test yourself if it's effective by asking yourself this question. Can I sit still between 1 and 10 minutes? Quiet, no noise, no talking, no stimulus, just hear myself breathe. And if the thought of that stresses you out, you're already over the edge. And if you can begin to do this in a 60-second window, just get quiet, you'll find yourself being able to not only manage stress, but you'll take action and authority over stress.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. I mean, through my outdoor pursuits, hunting and fishing and hiking and so forth, I wind up spending quite a bit of time on my own and often long drives to get somewhere. And had a friend recently, who was sort of told me he's very impressed with my ability to sort of do this. And I thought that was a really strange thing. But I guess to me, I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm comfortable with my own thoughts. I can have a quiet mind, albeit somewhat some of these activities are laser focused on an intent. But it was interesting to me to hear this gentleman, say that's just something that would be so foreign to me and so difficult for me to do. So it's interesting that you brought that up. So you kind of touched on it, but obviously, what we put into our mouths on a regular basis has a fundamental effect on our health. What sort of dietary recommendations do you support or endorse?
Well, first of all, let's remember the size of the heart versus the size of the stomach. People that can see this, if you can't, I'm making two fists and putting them together. That's generally the size of an adult heart that sits just off left center in the center of the chest behind the sternum. Okay. The stomach, now get this, is, one of those. One fist. So if the stomach is literally half the size of the heart, think about how much food it takes to fill that fist-size stomach. but also understand that the stomach can stretch about as big as a basketball if you choose to. And you can eat and that thing will stretch out. It's very elastic with the tissues, these loose fibers, right? Loose connective tissue. It'll stretch out a lot like a balloon, but it's not healthy. So when we talk about diet or nutritional intake, we don't need to talk about calories. We need to talk about the right foods in the right amount. And the right foods are basically natural foods made in the same package that God intended. So in other words, when you go out fishing and hunting, there you go. That's a great way to deal with real food. If you can imagine food growing from a tree, from the ground, below the ground, swimming through the river or the creek or the lake, or walking through a forest, that is food. Anything that's in packages and processed is not food. So I tell people all the time, do not diet. Eat to live and eat real food. If you do that, you're not going to go wrong. And then a tip for people to understand is you don't have to eat a certain number of meals per day. That is an erroneous, false teaching. You do have to eat when you're hungry, but you don't have to eat when you're not hungry. There's no rule that says you have to do that. I like to actually as well compress my times of eating. In other words, I don't like to really eat all the time as much as the waking hours of the day. And I'm older, so I get it, you know, that maybe people are trying to get bigger, faster, younger in life, and they're growing. I'm not. But ultimately, the more you can compress the window with which you eat, the more time you compress with which you have food in your belly. Now, this is a powerful thing I'm getting ready to say, and I hope people really take note of this. The body cannot repair itself. It cannot restore itself, and it cannot rebuild itself while there's food in the belly, because the priority of the body is always dealing with what is the greatest threat right now. The greatest threat right now in that when there's food in the body has to sift through all that rubble, determine what is a waste product versus what is good. It doesn't have time to fix anything at that point because it's dealing with the immediate threat. And I'm using that as a clear analogy. Food and the way we bring it in today and what it's composed of is a threat. Right. Which goes hand in hand with what I said earlier. When you're stressed, stress is interpreted, genetically speaking, as being chased by a bear. And so when you're being chased by a bear and you have food in your belly, which one takes priority? The bear. So digestion goes down. So if you can get where you're more inclined to have a greater increased time in which you're fasted and which you're non-stressed, you're going to get better digestion, better assimilation, better restoration, rebuilding, and repair.
And so that would, I guess for most people, an earlier supper versus a later supper, maybe less food at that time, more food in the sort of midday to afternoon period?
Yes. The old saying goes like this, breakfast like a king, lunch like a queen, dinner like a pauper. But if you can begin the first meal of the day, if that's your time you break your fast, and it's typically going to be in the morning or late morning, or maybe if you wait until noon, you can. But I would probably have the majority of my food at that time. Okay. And then tone it down, because you don't sleep well. And you, again, sleep is about fasting and restoration, isn't it? Recovery. But if you have food in your belly, you're not going to do any of that well while you're sleeping, which is the primary time in which we're healing. So I like to have about a 3-hour window between my last food intake and the time that I lay down. It is a negative thing to do significantly if we eat and then we lay straight down, because our digestion is going to be completely and totally impaired.
Yeah. As well as the recovery process.
Yes, exactly.
Which I guess at that point, those calories that you're taking in are more likely to be stored as adipose tissue as opposed to constructing and repairing.
That's right. Because when the food is in the gut, the body has to say, what of this am I going to keep? Not sure about. Let me make an immunological decision. Then what am I going to throw into the waste can or the toilet, my excrement, right? Through urine or fecal matter. And it has to go through this decision process all the time. And it does this through the process of digestion and really assessment, I call it. So once we decide what it's going to keep, the body will extract those nutrients from the GI tract into the bloodstream to be transported down, to be assimilated into our cells, back to our cells again, where the cells can receive instruction of needed repair and begin to lay out and roll out recipes from the DNA to create tissues and proteins to bring repair to the tissues and the organs. And so it's a system that we don't want to see disrupted. And if it gets disrupted, every system of the body will follow suit and be disrupted as well.
That's some excellent advice. That's I haven't heard it put that way, but it makes great sense. One of the other, you know, interesting new narratives that's coming out of the mainstream is the vilification of meat and animal products or byproducts as unsustainable, unhealthy, yet promoting products such as insect-derived protein. What are your thoughts on this subject?
Clearly, they're trying to generate dysfunction in the farming and beef industry. Look, red meats don't hurt anybody. They don't. Bottom line is, it's the sourcing of them that has created a problem. In America, we have what's called confined animal feeding operations, which puts a bunch of cows in a small area, and it doesn't give them ability to move because we don't want them to move a lot. We want them to get fat fast. And we feed them all kinds of crap through genetic modified corn and wheat products. We make them as fat, as fast as possible. And we feed them growth hormone and steroids to make them even grow fatter as fast as possible. Exercise is forbid for a cow. We put them near other cows so they cannot exercise. And we give them antibiotics so they don't get sick. And then we sell them by weight. In other words, the whole beef industry, the whole American beef industry, I should say, is completely riddled with selling the most unhealthy cows for the most money. And then we consume that. I mean, and we think that's not going to make us fat as humans. Stop. Because the toxins that we have within our bodies are stored within the fat tissue. What makes us think they're not stored within the fat tissue of animals? Yeah. On the contrary, when you have a healthy animal, cow, elk, bear, deer, caribou, whatever the case may be, you get some of the finest nutrition through iron, B12, and even some fatty acids. They're incredibly efficient. And then if you go ahead and you were to venture out and start eating, guess what? Maybe an elk liver. Imagine that. You might find some hidden treasures in there that would really help you. The opposite of this is these people like Bill Gates trying to promote things like the Impossible Burger.
Right.
Which are genetically modified soy, which is estrogenic. In other words, there's two receptors. There's an alpha receptor and a beta receptor to estrogen. Alpha is proliferative. Beta is non-proliferative. Okay, when I say proliferative, I'm saying promoting growth. Beta is not promoting growth. Soy that's not genetically modified hits the beta receptor. Yeah. Soy that is genetically modified hits the alpha receptor, which does what to people? Well, it can promote cancers, it can promote fatness, and it exposes younger people to multiple hormone or estrogenic substances earlier in life, creating faster puberty, faster growth, more exposure to, again, more synthetic hormones.
That's wild. And to your knowledge, Dr. Sherwood, has there been any studies looking at the metabolites from some of the estradiol and trenbolone that these feedlot cattle are fed with? I mean, that can't be, it can't be good for people to be consuming those metabolites.
Yeah, I think when you look at it, like, there's they're going to kind of shy away from studies like that. But we actually have tests that we do. One is called a dried urine testing comprehensive hormone, looks at the metabolites of hormones within humans. It's a urine test. And we're actually able to tell, you know, how much a person is producing and how much is metabolized. And is it metabolizing down the right or the wrong pathway? Wrong pathway would be increased likelihood of breaking DNA, creating these carcinogenic cellular activity scenarios that we talked about earlier. So you can do it, but people should know this too, that the fat, the excess fat on anything is a potential storage for these fat-loving toxins that are there. Remember, toxins are typically lipophilic. They love fat. And if we can't get them transformed out of the body through a detoxification process, they'll get stored in the body. That's why people need to understand to be as lean as possible, have less excess fat as possible is good. And also know that the brain is mostly fat, like 65%. So you could get some toxins stored there, which is a critical component, most likely of this rapid increase of Alzheimer's dementia.
Interesting, which of course is part of that whole low fat movement. And I mean, my personal dietary regime is one of high fat, high protein vegetables. Yep. and kind of what I call conditional carbohydrates. So, you know, carbohydrate backloading after exercise, or small portions, but of oatmeal, sort of midday, mid-morning. And it's been working really well in terms of, you know, mental acuity, leanness. I mean, I'm as lean as I've ever been. And, you know, I go through half a pound of butter a week and a quart of cream. So it's that whole thing of fat makes you fat is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, you obviously can't eat that level of caloric content if you're sedentary and you don't have a physical structure that demands that kind of caloric intake. But that to me seems to be a very workable situation. Again, you know, you have to be careful where those fat sources are coming from. And if we just touch base on the beef industry again, you know, I think one of the modern malaises is our modern agriculture practices. And I think we need to get back to more regenerative agriculture, where we've got these ungulates that are on the farms, on the range, moving through the pastures, and people should be consuming grass-fed beef that perhaps is hay finished or grain finished for a short period of time in a pasture setting. Because I think, you know, the difference from a wild animal who, you know, is essentially a supreme athlete who has next to no body fat, the table quality of that is a little inferior in terms of taste and mouthfeel to something with a little bit more fat. I mean, we always joke it'd be great to find a moose somewhere and stick them in a pasture for a month or so to get some real
funny
out of them.
Yeah, when we you know, kill venison, and of course, you know, deer. And interestingly enough, sometimes you have to mix a little bit of beef fat with it to even make it where it will stick together and even make into some kind of a patty to make into a burger of sorts. But that's part of it. You know, I think that people need to begin to understand that there's a way to get back to that more natural life. And the good thing about a cow, if you get a male and female cow, guess what? You might have
more cows.
Calves. It might be good, right?
There you go. So, you know, as we're moving into the awful time of the year here, which is probably not as awful for you as it is for us up here, as the days get shorter and cooler, people seem to generally have a negative response to the seasonal shift, which creates some level of intrinsic stress, you know, call it the winter blues, if you will. That situation, coupled with lower vitamin D levels, seems to promote the onset of a mental malcontent, a potential illness. What are your thoughts here in terms of how people can combat this seasonal issue?
Well, certainly there is a clinical name for it. It's called seasonal affective disorder, or better known as SAD. And interestingly enough, what you can't do during the SAD is eat the SAD diet, which is Standard American Diet. So too sad make it even more bad. So I hope people caught that. But the bottom line is, man, you know, we have to make ourselves more active, because as the days shorten and darkness increases, no question the lack of vitamin D has a massive effect upon our brain health. I do recommend people increase the amount of vitamin D, especially in the winter. I've had many people, and I live in the southern part, I would say, of the United States. Having said that, people should know this is a truth. Even in the summertime, I am consuming 5,000 IU of vitamin D daily. Wintertime, it is absolutely incredible important to keep that level or even higher. And the darker your skin is, the more you need. And just think through that like that. And then again, make oneself active. It's not a negative thing to have the winter time. I mean, you can actually look at it from the other side and say, okay, when it gets dark quicker, maybe I need to start winding down and maybe I need to start working on my sleep a little bit. Again, don't stop exercising. Don't stop your D, but use it kind of like the animals do. They use it for restorative purposes. So there's a reason for seasons, right? But the bottom line is we have to stay connected. Now, the weather turns colder. Social gatherings begin to go down. And so we need to make sure that we maintain social gatherings. Make sure that even you dress appropriately, get out in the cold weather, expose yourself sometimes, because that's actually healthy and builds more resilience. The more temperature fluctuations you get used to, I'm talking not getting out there and walking around the snow with bare feet, but I'm talking about getting out there and getting active in it. So you actually can put on a pair of snowshoes and get out there and get some really good exercise in. So we need to make sure we do all those things daily, summer or winter, but especially in the winter.
Yeah, that's good. And I read on your site there in one of your articles, you're talking about quiet and stillness. You want to cover that for us? I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think you've been out there before on a hunt, right? You're there and it's quiet and you see and you feel and experience nature. You're not saying anything. You're just listening. So you're really using, and I like to look at this as we got two ears and one mouth for a reason. You know, sometimes I think we just use one of them way too much. And these two, not enough. I figure that because you got two of these and one of these, maybe we should do this twice as much as we do this.
Sure.
And I find that the quietude is for me, it's peace. And I have not met anybody yet, Michael, that hasn't experienced peace in the quiet.
Right.
And it's really talking to self about saying, hey, let me just begin to listen for a moment and quit talking, because if I'm talking all the time, you know, even myself, I can't listen while I'm talking and I don't hear as well. If, you know, you were to be getting in some sort of, not heated, but passionate conversation with your lady or something like that, have we not seen the regression of a situation when both are talking and we see the situation get better when one doesn't miss a good opportunity to shut up, like I like to say, you know, and tone it down? And there is peace within quiet. So I encourage everybody, like I said a few moments ago, to take some time every day and just sit there and get quiet. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's everything right with that. And if you want to combat stress, you want to have a better life. If I had one thing I would say to people in today's world, make time for quiet.
That's a wise advice. And then the other point within that article that I thought was very interesting was the working on your skin, invigorating your largest organ. Fill us in on some details there. I thought that was quite interesting.
Well, look, your skin is your largest organ. It has quite the responsibility, doesn't it? It lets things out and it keeps things out. At the same time, it's a barrier of sorts, and it's also your main interaction of defense from the environment. It's like your armor, but it has permeability. And so I look at the skin like this thing needs to be cared for. It needs sun exposure. We know that. It also needs to sweat. We know that. That's important because activity will do that. And we also need it. It needs good care. And this is something that my wife and I have especially taken a lot of stock in over the course of time. When you look at the skin, there's multiple layers of that skin. And we want to look at the epidermis, you know, and then right below that, you get into this area where collagen is formed. And as we age, as we know, things begin to sag. Well, that's unfortunate. You know, we lose the collagen elasticity and elastin in our faces and all these things begin to fall. Well, you can actually improve that a little bit by getting out there and being active and then going back and taking collagen and taking good care of self. I even like to put a little bit of coconut oil on the skin to keep it soft sometimes. Good, pure, white coconut oil. And many times you can do those things and the skin will, it'll last. It doesn't have to get really super old looking. I mean, we're going to age, but my goodness, let's take care of the skin.
Yes. And of course, as the winter humidity declines, it becomes even more important to hydrate and assist in that membrane permeability there.
That's right. And coconut oil is incredible good for that, just by the way.
Okay. Any other specific steps or recommendations for folks to stay virus-free this upcoming cold and flu season?
Well, number one, don't fear them, right? Because the viruses are a part of our lives. I was talking to a couple earlier today, actually, here in my office about we were doing some GI MAP or GI, some stool test reviews. And they were like kind of freaked out because within that, it gave you measurable levels of different viruses. And they're like, oh my gosh, what do you mean? And I was able to explain to them that viruses are a part of our life. And it's our body's ability to adaptively adjust those through our adaptive immune system to build antibodies when we get exposed to various styles, types, and forms of viruses we haven't seen before. Having said that, the keys are thus. We want to make sure that we support the ability of the immune system to function. And that goes right back to our putting in real foods with real nutrients that can be really used to fuel the cells of the immune system, which is composed of the immune organ systems, including the white blood cells. So again, nutrition does that. Nutrients that one would want to have up solid and at good levels, vitamin D we talked about, vitamin C would be great, vitamin A is always good for barrier health. Zinc is good. You pretty much want to stay between about 20 and about 60 on that one. Don't go too high on zinc or that will deplete another mineral called copper. I do like vitamin E to a point, right? It's also good for skin health, just an FYI. And I like omega-3s because omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. And then obviously there are two to kind of round that out would be like a vitamin Bs and magnesium to help maintain good energy production within the cells that drive these organs and organ systems.
Excellent. Great recommendations. So on this recent trip to Florida, I noticed that there's a big difference in the sweetness of foods between Communist Canada here and down in Florida. It's pretty similar in your state of Oklahoma too, I believe. It seems like everything is sweetened, from the breads to the beverage to the sauces. Could this be one of the factors or causes of this diabetes epidemic that we're seeing sweeping across America?
Totally. Type 2 diabetes shouldn't exist, Michael, at all, in one single person across the world. And I frankly get pretty passionate about that because it's a self-created driven disease process that's mainly started right here in America through the initiation, production, and synthesis of the standard American diet, which is composed of the very same things you mentioned, which are going to be these genetically derived, heavily subsidized by the United States government, foods such as corn, soy, wheat products, and sugars. Now, having said that, there's two things with this that I want people to get. They are made to be addictive. Sugar drives dopamine better than cocaine. So just FYI, that's why things are sweet. The genetically derived, genetically rearranged proteins within the dairy and wheat industries in America, those new proteins are foreign to the body and they do become opioid-like substances. And they bind to the opioid receptors, giving you a feel-good high. And so we now, on one hand, we have sugar mimicking cocaine. On the other hand, we have these breads and grain products mimicking opioids. No wonder we have an epidemic. No wonder people can't stop. No wonder when you say stop eating the breads and grains, they can't. And no wonder they're served free in most restaurants.
Wow, that's incredible. And do you have some papers on that the GMO proteins being absorbed as opiates? I'd love to see those.
Yes, I will get you some data if you want to do some searching. This is for you and everybody else out there. Search the term exorphins, 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 and you're going to find a myriad of pieces of literature how these modified proteins become like morphine substances once they are digested in the gut. And specifically, you can look at the names of those exorphins called gliadomorphins, gluteomorphins, and caseomorphins.
Wow, that's shocking information. You know,
right? It's like, yeah. Oh no. Yeah.
It's, you know, no wonder we see this, all, you know, throw this out when I think you and I are pretty close to the same age, and, you know, swim lessons in the summertime or on the playground, you know, boys kind of looked like boys. There was the odd chubby guy who clearly had some sort of metabolic problem. But these days, you know, there's 8 and 12 year old boys with boobs, guts, you know, love handles hanging out. And when I see this, I mean, I shake my head, and you know, it's child abuse. But yet when you supply this type of information, I mean, these kids are no longer sentient in terms of their choices because they're being driven from an addiction that, you know, they have no control over at that point.
Yeah, it's very sad because statistics in America do not tend to be favorable. It is predicted at present that 1 in 3 of those children will become type 2 diabetic and on medication by the time they're 40. It's further predicted in America, and this is a shocking statistic right now, that you look back at the idea of autism, right? 1 in 40,000 40 years ago, 1 in less than 40 now. If the trends continue, we'll be at 1 in 2 by 2050. The idea of obesity across the North American continent is pathetic. We are trending so fast in that direction. We went from literally very few people 60, 70 years ago being obese to now you and I would be looked at as freaks. We are too radical. We're too strict. And why can't we just learn to live a little bit?
Yeah.
Sound familiar?
Heard that before, but I'll enjoy my lifestyle, and they can suffer with theirs. So just remaining with diabetes for a moment, and this sort of came upon this comment. There was a homeless gal who was obviously suffering from some mental illness, but also in the latter stages of diabetes, her lower legs were swollen, covered in sores, and it was quite a sight to see. And I think many people have a false assumption that diabetes is sort of a minor or treatable condition, whereas in the absence of significant lifestyle changes, diabetes is a slow, crippling terminal condition that doesn't end well. And the statistics aren't at the tip of my tongue here, but I think that there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 million Americans over the next 10 to 15 years that could be exiting their life in this, you know, catastrophic way. Your thoughts there?
Well, there's 1 in 2 Americans right now that are insulin resistant or type 2 diabetic, and most don't know it because there's underlying, like looking at hemoglobin A1C doesn't quite cut it, because hemoglobin A1C is typically done fasting. Well, that doesn't tell you anything, right? So I look at things like fasting insulin and C-peptide. I can tell whether a person has underlying insulin resistance far before the hemoglobin A1C tells you anything. When you look at type 2 diabetes, you think about the damage to the blood cells, the damage to the vascular system. Think about all the glycation, the oversugared, right? You oversugar anything, it makes it sticky. It doesn't work right. It doesn't flow right. And I'm using terms that people would understand. So when you damage the vascular system because of lifestyle, because of too much sugar, you not only damage the vascular system blood-wise, but you also create heart disease. You also create brain disease, because type 2 diabetes is heart disease, and type 2 diabetes is the onset of type 3 diabetes, which is another name for Alzheimer's, and it's all driven by the Western diet that's laden and loaded with carbohydrates that are not essential. There's not one essential carbohydrate. I think you mentioned that earlier. There's ones that we might use post-workout that are good to sort of backfill those muscle bellies and drive, you know, utilize insulin appropriately, but they are not designed to be the primary sources of fuel. Our fat that we take in and on our bodies is designed by very nature to be the primary fuel source, as evidenced by a simple caloric calculation. 1 gram of protein and 1 gram of carbohydrates, both respectively, equate to approximately 4 potential units of calories, energy, whereas 1 gram of fat potentially holds 9 calories or units of energy. So fat is way more fuel efficient, and we should be teaching and training our young people. It should be taught in the highest level. It should be taught at schools. It should be modeled in school cafeterias. It should be taught in the homes. It should be taught on every platform, everywhere, because if you want to save the population from a lot of misery and heartache, teach them the fundamentals of lifestyle.
Amen. Amen. So what are some ideas that people can use to avoid excessively taxing their pancreas and their insulin system, and ultimately avoiding this disease condition?
Well, they can fast, first of all, and that fasting is a profoundly effective strategy towards lowering the production of insulin. Just keep in mind, too, that insulin is only driven out by need. What creates the need is a lot of glucose in the blood system that is driven by too many carbohydrates or even too much protein that's been taken in, because fat cannot be converted into glucose. Cannot. But proteins and carbohydrates can. So we can get too many of those, which drive the blood sugar too high, prompting the need for insulin to help escort those glucose molecules into the liver cells or into the muscle cells. Now, having said that, what's the best way to stop the need for insulin to be secreted from the pancreas? Well, we slow down the glucose. What's the best way to do that? Not eat. So fasting is terrific. Compressing the time with which we eat, as I talked about earlier, or maybe it's said another way, increasing the time with which we fast, making sure that when we eat something, it is not processed at all, no go, no how, especially if you're overweight. Don't do that. And then when you do eat, if you can kind of use exactly the formula that you just stated earlier, you know, the good protein, good quality fats that you named, very good job with that. And then if you are already having blood sugar issues, stay with above ground, non-root vegetables as your primary plant sources. You might even have to tone down the amount of fruit for a time. Normally, no. But there are situations where the answer is yes, you have to. And then if you're on insulin or something like that, or on blood sugar lowering medications, you better make sure you're working with a doctor, because when you begin to behave like that lifestyle wise, those medications can push your blood sugar too low. And especially with insulin, that can kill you. So do not go in any crazy move like that unless you get with a doctor that's willing to help you and work with you, especially with the uses of insulin.
Yeah, very good. And to conclude this segment here, also like to cover inflammation and why we should all be diligently working towards reducing inflammation within our bodies.
When we look at inflammation, it's got kind of a bad term out there. It's a bad name. Now, inflammation's bad, but let's kind of back up a little bit and let's look at the purpose of inflammation. So our immune system may be akin, Michael, as a military. You know, have our Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, Space Force, surveilling all around us and all in us. And when something gets inside of our borders that we don't need, we have to alert the rest of the troops there's something wrong. We have to alert the rest of our body there's something wrong. Those signals, in part, would be inflammatory signals. Not that that's a bad thing. It's actually a good thing on the outset. It's good to recognize a threat and notify everybody else. So it's good to have that good, strong response. And genetically speaking, the majority of people walking on planet Earth have microscopically or microevolutionarily developed a very strong inflammatory response. That's good, right? Now, when you put these genes in an environment that is pro-inflammatory by environmental forces itself, through sometimes the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat, and the activity we don't do, the sleep we don't get, and the stress we have, we're always being bombarded with this idea of things that instigate an uptick and start up the immune system driving inflammation. The majority of people today are chronically and systemically inflamed, which does nothing more than weaken the immune system, get it where it can't respond. Every disease process has a component of chronic systemic inflammation. The best way to get that where you got it under control is to do an anti-inflammatory food program like we just laid out a couple of times in this program. Do that. Don't waver. Don't ask. Just do it. It is right. And the second thing you can do with that is make sure your omega-3 fatty acids are up there. if you're measuring like a whole blood omega index or something like that, maybe somewhere around 8%. And to get there, you're probably going to have 3, maybe 4 grams of a high grade, high dose EPA DHA containing omega-3 fatty acid. And that also helps control inflammation. Routine exercise is good. Good sleep is good. And good recovery is also good to control inflammation. And making sure you have excess body fat down, because the adipocytes or the fat cells, they actually secrete inflammatory signals called adipokines when we start growing too much fat too fast.
Which, of course, we've seen with the recent COVID issue that the obese were the first to drop. And it sounds like this whole quagmire of chronic inflammation and reduced immunity is the maybe the underlying cause for that.
Totally. No one addressed that, Michael. And that just completely got under my skin and really made me angry. I waited for leaders governmentally, medically, spiritually to offer some sort of an insight to that. And you know what? You still don't see it. So Mike, I really absolutely commend you. I commend you, sir, for doing what you're doing right now with this broadcast. And I implore the people that are hearing this to share it wherever you are with as many people as you can, because this can save your life and it can save the life of your loved ones. And it might even save the life of your whole darn community. Right. Because no one talked about this from the get-go. We have created a world, especially North America, where chronic systemic inflammation is the norm. And because of that, we have little to no resiliency to adapt and overcome anything, whether it's a vaccine initiating the immune system or a virus initiating the immune system. It doesn't matter. We still can't deal with it.
Yeah, that's. I think the only researcher that I've come across who's made some very strong public statements is Dr. Paul Elias Alexander from Trinidad Tobago. Spent some time in Canada. I think he's now in America because, of course, Canada's a devolving into a despotic communist state. And he was on, I believe, either Tucker Carlson or one of the major broadcasts. Where he was saying, you know, that America has an obesity problem, and the reason that people are dropping like flies is because they're obese. And, you know, before we tell people to put masks on, let's tell people to, you know, stop drinking that pop and eating the rest of the crap and get that weight down. I mean, a proper yeah. BMI. I mean, of course, guys like you and I are outside of the BMI index, but that's a different story. Yeah. You know, and I joke with people that, you know, if you, as a guy, you wake up in the morning and you can't see your penis there where you're having your morning wee over your belly, you got a problem. And, you know, well before it gets to the point where you can't see your knees, you got to be making some lifestyle adjustments. Otherwise it's all downhill for you.
It is, and it's unfortunate that no one has really been talking about that so much. So I commend the people that are, and it needs to happen more often, and it needs to be straight up. And I was hoping way back when they started kicking out stimulus money, they would not kick out stimulus money for people, but they would kick out excess vitamin D for everybody and maybe buy people a salad that sure. they had to eat once a day. Yeah. But they didn't love us. They used us. They used yeah. us for profit. And it makes me very sad. It makes me grieved and it makes me angry, but that's where we are right now in our world.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and these bastions of truth and reason need to shine brightly. Otherwise, everyone's lost.
That's right.
So a couple final questions here, Dr. Sherrod, if I may. If you could go back in time and speak with yourself as a young 18 or 20-year-old man, what advice would you have for that young guy?
Seek wisdom. And look, I mean, you can be as smart as you want. You can learn as much stuff as you want. You can be as talented as you want to be. But if you don't use that talent, you don't use that knowledge right, which requires wisdom, it can be used wrong. And I would love to go back to myself and say, Mark, would you just learn the concept of wisdom, which is the correct use of knowledge, as opposed to the incorrect use of knowledge, which is foolishness. Because we live in a world where there's knowledge is everywhere and anybody can find anything and do anything they want. Which is good, but it can also become damaging. So it would be absolutely learn wisdom.
Yeah, very good. And what's on the horizon for you? What are your next moves?
Well, we're going to keep out of here doing our best here in our state and around the country and world doing what we do. We got a book we're going to probably come out with after the first year. Working title is, first time here, it's going to be called Free, F-R-E-E. Pretty cool. We also have a movie that's coming out again. We filmed it last year. It's called WWJR, and it will be out sometime late in the year or the first of the year. We finished filming another movie this summer, which will come out next year as well. And so we're just going to keep pushing on the narrative of giving people hope, Michael, because we're going to use everything we can. We actually did develop a new product called Kingdom Fuel, which I'm very excited about. It's a nice organic pea protein. It's got organic greens and reds. It's got fiber and multivitamin mineral. And it's got a 2-year shelf life designed to sort of solve and mitigate some of the food crisis.
Yeah, excellent. And obviously some antioxidants and anti-inflammatories in there as part of the package.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Total meal.
Excellent. So Dr. Sherwood, if people would like to learn more about you and your functional medicine clinic, where would I direct them?
They can go straight to Sherwood.tv, Sherwood.tv, and people can connect with us everywhere. And certainly is an honor to help people. We have free, you know, newsletters, blogs, videos. We got a television show that goes out there a couple times a week, and people can get connected. And look, we can work with you or not, but certainly we want to be a part of your life and give you some hope, a nice infusion of hope, and maybe something you can hang on to and something can be useful.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, sir, I appreciate your time, your wealth of knowledge, and I really enjoy and welcome your message of hope. I mean, that's something that we all need here as we try to unwind ourselves from this madness. And, you know, these like-minded folks need to band together and create that community of holistic wellness and holistic thought to push us through the madness.
Oh, yeah. And you do such a great job. I'm so honored to be with you again. And I was looking forward to this. So good discussion.
Excellent. Well, I think our next one might be on anti-aging and to have a discussion on that for the folks our age and give them some tips and techniques as to how to preserve their youth as long as they can.
We'll teach them how to stay 29 for a longer time.
That's fantastic. All right, sir. God bless. All the best. And we'll be in touch.
God bless you, man. Thank you.
Cheers. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.